Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Up to No Good. This has the potential to be your favorite Harry Potter podcast if you give it a chance. I am your host, Lindsay Taylor Siplin, and I really don't have any updates other than if you hear some, like, jingling or ringing in the background of this, I'm super sorry, but my mom's cats recently got new collars, and they have little bells on them, and they walk around a lot, so I don't know if you'll be able to hear that, but if you do, please forgive me. So, without further ado, let's get into episode 4 of Up to No Good, covering chapters 7 and 8 of Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. So, chapter 7's title is The Sorting Hat. So, we left off of chapter 6 with Hagrid knocking on the castle door, and the beginning of chapter 7 picks up right off of there, and the door swings open, and a tall black-haired witch in emerald green robes is there. So we know that this is McGonagall, and Hagrid introduces the first years to her. So Harry's first thought when he sees her is that she is not someone to F with. I feel like McGonagall gives me the same vibes as like a black grandma, because they're really nice and they have the potential to be really enjoyable and fun as long as you don't mess with them, because if you like mess with them or set them off, I promise you will be miserable and you will regret it. Anyway, so McGonagall takes over and she brings the first years through the entrance hall and takes them into an empty chamber. So she told them that before they can join the rest of the school at the banquet in the Great Hall, they have to be sorted into their houses, and that sorting is very important because your house is basically your family while you're at Hogwarts. There are 4 houses: Gryffindor, Hufflepuff, Ravenclaw, and Slytherin. You can gain house points when you do something good, and any rule breaking or bad behavior means that house points will be deducted. And at the end of the year, whatever house has the most points gets the house cup, which is a, and I quote, great honor. And this makes me think of when I was in middle school, and we do this in high school, at pep rallies, you're like separated by grades, so you sit with everyone in your grade, and people come around, and you're supposed to scream as loud as you can, and whichever class is the loudest gets the spirit stick. And I feel like so far from what I can remember about the house cup and what has been explained about it, this is very similar to the spirit stick in the fact that they only have value because a faculty member tells you they do. Like, it's literally only bragging rights for these. You don't even get, like, a pizza party at the end of it. So McGonagall tells them to wait in that little chamber that she took them in, and she'll come back when they're ready. So as she walks away, the narrator says that her eyes lingered for a moment on Neville's cloak, which was fastened under his ear. And I definitely know that I am not the most knowledgeable on how cloaks work, but how do you even manage to fasten it under your left ear? Like, shouldn't it be fastened at kind of like the front of your neck or something, like so that it closes properly, kind of like a coat? But I don't know how it would be fastened only under your left ear. But that is Neville's business, so I'm going to mind mine. Anyway, none of the first years know how they're going to be sorted into their houses, so Harry asks Ron, but Ron says that he thinks there's some sort of test, and Fred told him that it hurts a lot, but he thinks he was joking. And right now, Harry is scared because he doesn't know any magic, and he doesn't want to embarrass himself in front of the whole school, which is understandable, because he hasn't even, like, had a chance to really be there yet. They literally just walked into the castle. And Hermione is there too, obviously, and she's whispering very quickly about all of the spells that she's known, like that she's learned so far, and she's wondering which one she'll need to use. And the book literally says that Harry tried hard not to listen to her, and I definitely feel Harry in this moment, because I, like, am a very good student, but I try not to come over-prepared to test, and if I do, I'm not going to be that one jerk that's there talking about how I know every single thing, and I know people like that, and everyone is just like, okay, we get it, you know the stuff, it is 9:15 in the morning, we're in Algebra 2, what do you get for this? Nothing. And It's like, we're in high school. You don't get an end-of-the-year bonus for doing well on an Algebra 2 test. There's no need for all of that extra foolishness. And apparently, Harry is more nervous right now than the time that he had to take home a school report to the Dursleys that said that he had somehow turned his teacher's wig blue. And I just think that that is amazing. Not that Harry's nervous. I think it's amazing that he managed to turn his teacher's wig blue. I know that it was an accident, like he didn't even really try to do it, or he didn't know what he was doing at the time, but that is just great for him. Good for you, Harry. Keep causing trouble. So, while Harry is waiting for Professor McGonagall to come back for all of the first years, they start screaming and jumping in the air because about 20 ghosts just come through the back wall. And they are pearly white and slightly transparent and just gliding across the room, talking to each other, and they barely even notice the first years. The narrator says that they look like they're arguing, and one of the ghosts is said to look like a fat little monk, and we will learn that this one is the fat friar. So, apparently the ghosts are arguing about whether or not they've given Peeves enough chances because he's giving them a bad name and he's not even a ghost and he just makes the ghosts look bad. And then, suddenly, one of the ghosts that was speaking suddenly notices the first year and asks what they're doing there, and that is when the fat friar speaks up, who is also a ghost, as we know, and he says that they are the new students waiting to be sorted. The fat friar says that he used to be in Hufflepuff, and he hopes to see them, well, he hopes to see the ones that are in Hufflepuff House, because he is the house ghost for Hufflepuff. Eventually, McGonagall comes back, and she tells the ghost to move along, because they were, like, lingering there, talking to the first years too long, and the sorting ceremony is about to begin. And then she lines all of the first years up before they walk across the hall and into the Great Hall. So, they're walking into the Great Hall, and Harry just thinks that it looks amazing because there are thousands and thousands of candles, and there are four long tables with students sitting at them, and they all have golden plates and goblets, and there is a long table, quote, at the top of the hall, and I think that is a very interesting way to say in the front of the hall. Like, I understand, because it makes sense, we know what they mean, but I just wonder why they didn't just say in the front of the hall. Maybe that's like a British thing, it's just like makes more sense for them to say at the top of the hall, so I don't know. Anyway, there is a long table at the top of the hall, and it is for the teachers to sit at, so Professor McGonagall leads the first years up there near that table, and they end up facing the students and ghosts in the crowd. And Harry is trying to avoid everyone's faces, just watching all of the first years, so he looks up, and the ceiling looks like a night sky, and that is when he hears Hermione whispering about how it is bewitched to look like that, and she read it in Hogwarts: A History. Of course she did. And Harry finds it hard to believe that there's even a ceiling there at all, and it's not just the sky, because it is also, like, a very high ceiling, so you can't just, like, see the top of it, even if it did look like the stars. But Harry looks down again, and McGonagall is placing a stool in front of the line of first years, and it has a pointed wizard's hat on it that is patched and frayed and extremely dirty, and the narrator says that Aunt Petunia would not have let it in the house. So Harry thinks to himself that maybe he has to try to get a rabbit out of the hat, and then he sees everyone, like, that's sitting at the tables in the hall just staring at the hat, so he looks at it too, and when he does, it moves, and a rip near the brim opened wide like a mouth, and the hat began to sing. So, I am not going to sing for you because I don't want to embarrass myself that badly 4 episodes into this podcast. Well, embarrass myself more than I already have, but I will read you the lyrics because I think they're pretty relevant. The lyrics go, "Oh, you may not think I'm pretty, but don't judge on what you see. I'll eat myself if you can find a smarter hat than me. You can keep your bowlers black and your top hat sleek and tall, for I'm the Hogwarts sorting hat and I can cap them all." There's nothing hidden in your head the sorting hat can't see, so try me on and I will tell you where you ought to be. You might belong in Gryffindor, where dwell the brave of heart, their daring, nerve, and chivalry set Gryffindors apart. You might belong in Hufflepuff, where they are just and loyal, those patient Hufflepuffs are true, and unafraid of toil, or yet in wise old Ravenclaw, if you're already mine, where those of wit and learning will always find their kind, or perhaps in Slytherin, where you'll meet your real friends, those cunning folk use any means to achieve their ends. So put me on, don't be afraid, don't get in a flap, you're in safe hands, though I have none, for I'm a thinking cap. And that is the end of the song. So basically the hat is just saying that Gryffindors are brave, Hufflepuffs are loyal, Ravenclaws are smart, and Slytherin are cunning. I'm sure most people know this because, like, Harry Potter is just, like, such a cultural phenomenon, but I like its hat. I kind of completely forgot it sang a song at first. And as the hat finishes its song, the whole crowd bursts into applause, and it bows to each of the four tables before going still again, like the toys in Toy Story when Andy is coming. So Ron whispers that he is going to kill Fred because he was going on about having to wrestle a troll, and Harry thinks that having to try on a hat is a lot better than having to do a spell or something, but he wishes that they could do it in private without everyone watching, because the hat seems to be asking a lot, because Harry doesn't feel particularly brave or smart or any of the specific house traits. And McGonagall steps up with a roll of parchment in her hand and says that when she calls your name off of it, you're going to put the hat on to be sorted. So Hannah Abbott goes first, and she goes to Hufflepuff, and so does Susan Bones. But Terry Boot goes to Ravenclaw, and so does Mandy Brocklehurst. I just noticed that I have heard of Susan Bones and Hannah Abbott, and Terry Boot, but I don't think that Mandy Brocklehurst is ever mentioned again in the series. So maybe I will find out what's going on with Mandy. Anyway, I should also mention that after each person is sorted into their house, the house that they go to, everyone gets up and they clap for them and they shake their hand as they walk to their table. And Lavender Brown is the first person to be sorted into Gryffindor, and then Millicent Bulstrode goes to Slytherin. At this point, Harry feels a bit sick because he's remembering sports lessons at his old school, and he would always be the last to be picked because no one wanted Dudley to think that they liked Harry, even though Harry wasn't bad at sports. And next, Justin Finch-Fletchley goes to Hufflepuff, and Harry notices that sometimes the hat immediately knows where to put someone, but other times it takes a little bit to decide. So Seamus Finnegan goes to Gryffindor, along with Hermione Granger, which causes Ron to groan. And now Harry has the thought, and he's worrying that he just won't be chosen at all, and he'll sit there with the hat on him for a while until McGonagall takes it off and says that there had been a mistake and that he needs to get back on the train to go back to the Dursleys. When Neville Longbottom is called, he fell over on his way to the stool, and the hat took a while to decide that he should be a Gryffindor, and Neville was so excited that he got up and, like, walked off with the hat, and then he had to jog back while people are laughing at him, and I kind of feel for Neville. Like, he hasn't even been there a whole day yet, and he's already kind of, like, made a bit of a faux pas. Anyway, the sorting hat barely touches Malfoy's head when it just immediately yells Slytherin. And after a while, Harry Potter is finally called. And as he is stepping forward, people are whispering all around the whole room. And they're like, oh, did she really say Potter? Is that the Harry Potter? And the last thing he sees before the hat basically covers, like, his whole head and eye area is that everyone in the hall is craning their necks to get a good look at him. So he waits for a bit, and then the hat finally starts speaking, and it says that it has a very difficult decision to make because he has plenty of courage and not a bad mind, and Harry has talent, and the hat says that it doesn't know where it should put Harry. So Harry says, not Slytherin, not Slytherin. And the hat asks if he's sure because he could be great in Slytherin and it will help him on his way to greatness. And the hat says that since he doesn't want to be in there, he should be in Gryffindor, and it shouts the last word, which is Gryffindor, so everyone in the crowd hears, and Harry barely notices that he gets the loudest shouts and claps out of all of the first years that have been sorted. And Percy, the prefect, gets up to shake his hand, and the Weasley twins, yo, we got Potter, we got Potter. And oh my gosh, this just makes me want to be the Weasley twins' best friends so badly. Like, I know everyone inserts themselves into the main character of the story, which is Harry Potter, but I know that if I were, let's say, Harriet Potter, I would just, like, want to hang out with them during the summers, and they're just, like, so cool. And, like, they're kind of jerks, but it's funny because they're not necessarily completely mean about it, because they only do that to people they are, like, close with, like, their friends and family, and I really like that. But getting back to the story, Harry sits down at the Gryffindor table and looks up to the high table where the teachers are sitting and sees Hagrid first, and Hagrid gives him a thumbs up. And in the center of the table, Albus Dumbledore is sitting, and Harry recognized him from the card off of his chocolate frog on the train. Harry also sees Professor Quirrell, who he met at the Leaky Cauldron, and he looks very peculiar in a large purple turban. So here, I'm going to stop for a quick sec because I told you guys in the first episode that I am reading the illustrated edition of this book, and on the page where Quirrell is mentioned, the illustration shows him as very clearly being a white man, and this is consistent with the movies, but I always thought of Quirrell as a brown person because wearing a turban would make more sense and it wouldn't look as out of place for this. Like, anyone can wear a turban, but I'm just saying that it is more out of place to see a white guy wearing a turban with very little explanation than it is to see a brown person. But yeah. So I don't know what JK originally had in mind, but she never really touched on the fact that it's weird that Quirrell is wearing a turban. So I just naturally interpreted that it would be a brown person instead of a white person. And even if he was originally, like, not thought of, they, like, she didn't think of him as having a race originally, because, like, that might have just, like, slipped her mind or something, like, she didn't, like, write that in. I think that this character would have been a great opportunity to have some diversity in the books. And we know that the books and movies, and apparently illustrations too, all have a staggering lack of diversity, and they kind of missed a great opportunity right here. And it could have been like in Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, the woman that played Hermione, I know it was a black woman, and everyone, like, well, not everyone, but a lot of people on Twitter were super mad about this, and JK, like, said that she never specifically mentioned that Hermione was a white person, and I feel like this would have been a great opportunity to do the same in the book, because, like, you could have easily just made Quirrell a brown person. But since he is a random white guy wearing a turban, I am reminded of book 5 in the Series of Unfortunate Events books. It's the Austere Academy, and, oh, spoiler alert if you haven't read these and want to, but Count Olaf shows up, and he's pretending to be a gym teacher, and to hide his identity, he's wearing a turban, and the kids know that he looks absolutely ridiculous, but, like, no one else is questioning it, so I'm wondering why they're treating Quirrell the exact same. They're just being like, I don't know. And yeah, that's kind of the end of my little tangent about a lack of diversity. Sorry. And Harry refocuses on the sorting, and there are only 3 people left. Lisa Turpin goes to Ravenclaw, Ron goes to Gryffindor, and Blaise the Beanie goes to Slytherin. And now that the sorting is over, Harry realizes that he is hungry, and it seems like the pumpkin pasties and snacks on the train were a long time ago. And Albus Dumbledore gets up from his seat and says, "Welcome to this new school year at Hogwarts," and before he begins the banquet, he wants to have a few words. And they are, "Nitwick, blubber, oddment, tweak. Thank you. And I kind of forgot about how much of an eccentric geezer Dumbledore, like, really is in the book, because we don't see as much of this in the movies. I don't know if this part of Dumbledore was in the movies, but in the books, I feel like so far, like, we haven't had that much interaction with him, but he has already been more of a silly headmaster than strictly a mentor, like in the movies. But Harry turns to Percy and asks if Dumbledore is a bit mad, meaning, is he crazy? And Percy says, mad? He's a genius, best wizard in the world, but he's a bit mad, yes. And I think it's really interesting because this is a big contrast between this Percy and the Percy that we'll come to know in the fifth book, and I guess, like, up until the seventh book, because Percy kind of begins to think of Dumbledore as a bit of an old kook and says that he should listen to the ministry, but right here Percy's saying that he's a genius and he's the best wizard ever. So Harry turns back to the table after talking to Percy for a bit, and his mouth just falls open because there are so many dishes in front of him full of a ton of food, and there's like a big list. There's like roast beef and chicken and pork chops. And at the end of like the list that the narrator gives, it says that there are mint humbugs. So I have no idea what a humbug is. So if someone wants to reach out and just tell me what a mint humbug is, please feel free. I will really appreciate it. I will sing you a song. I will give you a hug. I'll blow you a kiss. Okay, I probably won't do any of that, but I will say thank you. So we also learn that the Dursleys never exactly starved Harry, but he was never allowed to eat as much as he liked. So Harry gets a little bit of everything onto his plate except the humbugs, and everything is delicious. And one of the ghosts says that the food looks good while he's watching Harry cut up his steak, and Harry asks if they can eat, and the ghost says that he hasn't eaten in nearly 500 years, and he introduces himself as Sir Nicholas de Mimsey Porpington, and he is the Gryffindor house ghost. So Ron hears this and says that his brothers told him about him, and that he is nearly Headless Nick, but Sir Nicholas says that he prefers to be called Sir Nicholas de Mimsey. And Seamus hears this and asks how you can be nearly headless. So Sir Nicholas looks extremely miffed at this because their little talk isn't going how he wanted. So he takes his left ear and pulls on it, and his whole head swung off his neck and fell onto his shoulders as if it was on a hinge. And the narrator says that it was obvious that someone had tried to behead him but not done it properly. So, Nearly Headless Nick is very pleased at the stunned looks on the first year's faces, and he puts his head back on his neck and says that he hopes the new Gryffindors are going to help them win the house championship this year, because the Gryffindors have not gone this long without winning, and the Slytherins have got the cup for 6 years in a row now, and the Bloody Baron, who is the Slytherins' house ghost, is becoming almost unbearable. So Harry looks over to the Slytherin table, and he sees a ghost sitting there with a blank stare and a, like, gaunt face, and his robes are covered in silver blood. And he is sitting next to Malfoy, who does not look very happy with the seating arrangement. So Seamus asks how the Bloody Baron got covered in blood, and Nearly Headless Nick says that he never asks. We'll actually find out how the Bloody Baron got covered in blood in book 7, but I think it's really interesting right now that we could have learned it in one sentence, and most people probably would have forgotten about it because the books were published between, what, 1997 and 2007, so Nearly Headless Nick could have, like, been super vague about it, and it's plausible that readers would have forgotten about this little tidbit by then, but I'm happy that we don't find out why the Baron is covered in blood yet. And when everyone is finished eating dinner, the food disappears and dirt appears. Not dirt, dessert appears, I'm sorry. And Harry has a treacle tart. And once again, I feel the need to mention that I still don't know what that is yet. I've heard that they, like, make it on the Great British Bake Off, but I only watched the first season, and that was, like, what, 6 years ago now, so I'm sorry, I don't know what Treacle Tart is. But Seamus Finnegan starts talking, and he says that he is half and half, meaning that his dad is a muggle and his mom is a witch. And his mom didn't tell his dad that until after they were married, so he was shocked. And Neville says that his grandma has raised him and that she is a witch, but his family thought that he was going to end up being a muggle for a while. And apparently his great uncle Algie kept trying to catch him off guard and force him to do magic. And at one point, he ended up pushing him off of the end of Blackpool Pier, and that caused Neville to nearly drown, but he did not end up showing signs of magic until he was 8 years old. And the story goes that Neville was hanging out of an upstairs window by his ankles when he heard his great auntie Enid offer him some meringue, and he accidentally let go, but he was fine because he bounced into the garden, into the road. And everyone was so happy, and his grandma was crying because the family thought that he might not be magic enough to go to Hogwarts. But his great uncle Algie was so happy that he brought Neville his toad, Trevor. And on the other side of Harry are Percy and Hermione, and they're talking about lessons. And Hermione says that she is really interested in transfiguration, even though it's supposed to be really difficult. But Percy says that they'll be starting with small things like turning matches into needles. So Harry starts to feel sleepy, and he looks up at the high table and I quote, sees Hagrid drinking deeply from his goblet, unquote. I don't know about y'all, but why the narrator never mentions how much anyone else drinks. So I'm going to assume that Hagrid is an alcoholic. Like, we're not even halfway into this book yet, and they're just really laying it on thick. We get it. Anyway, Professor Quirrell is talking to a teacher with greasy black hair, a hooked nose, and sallow skin. So the hook-nosed teacher will learn he is Snape, and he looks past Quirrell's turban straight into Harry's eyes, and a sharp pain shot across the scar on Harry's forehead. And this causes Harry to say, like, ouch, and Percy asks what's wrong, but Harry says nothing is wrong, and he asks who the teacher talking to Professor Quirrell is. Percy says that it's Snape, and he teaches potions even though he doesn't want to. And everyone knows that he is after Quirrell's job because he knows an awful lot about the dark arts. So Harry keeps watching Snape, but Snape doesn't look at him again. And after a while, all the desserts disappear, and Professor Dumbledore gets up and says that he has some start of term notices. The first years should note that the forest on the grounds, well, I guess it's technically out of bounds of the grounds, is forbidden to everyone, and the older students should remember that too. And when he says that last bit, he looks in the direction of the Weasley twins. And this isn't even in my notes, but as I read this, I just really want a Weasley twins spinoff of just what they did during their, what, 6.5 years at Hogwarts. Anyway, Dumbledore also says that Mr. Filch, the caretaker, has asked him to remind everyone that they're not allowed to do magic between classes in the corridor. And Dumbledore also says that Quidditch trials will be held in the second week of term, and that if you're interested in playing, you should contact Madame Hooch. So Dumbledore also says that the third floor corridor on the right-hand side is out of bounds to everyone who does not wish to die a very painful death. And Harry laughs at this, but he is one of the few people who does. And Harry asks Percy, and Percy says that he's probably not joking because he usually gives a reason why they're not allowed to do certain things, like the Forbidden Forest has tons of monsters and stuff in it. But Dumbledore says that before they all go to bed, they're going to sing the school song, and he tells everyone to pick their favorite tune, and he flicks his wand, and a long golden ribbon flies out of it and forms the words of the song. Once again, I am definitely not going to sing for you, but I will read the words. Hogwarts, Hogwarts, Hoggy Warty, Hogwarts, Teach us something, please, whether we be old and bald or young with scabby knees. Our heads could do with filling with some interesting stuff, for now they're bare and full of air, dead flies and bits of fluff. So teach us things worth knowing, bring back what we've forgotten, just do your best, we'll do the rest, and learn until our brains all rot. Rot. And I was going to make some sort of correlation between my school's alma mater right here, when I remembered that I don't know a single word of it, not a single word. And I think that if it was just as catchy as this Hogwarts tune, I might know it, but it's not, so I can't. And everyone was singing in a different time, so they all ended at different times. And eventually, the Weasley twins, of course they are, because they're amazing, they are the only ones left singing, because they were singing along to a very slow funeral march. And Dumbledore conducted their last few lines with his wand, and he was one of the ones who clapped the loudest when they finally finished. And that is the end, and Dumbledore, well, that's not the end, but Dumbledore tells everyone to go to bed, and it's the end of the feast. So the Gryffindor first years follow Percy out of the Great Hall and up the marble staircase, and they are bothered by Peeves on their way to their dorms, and Peeves starts throwing sticks at Percy while he's invisible. So, Percy says that Peeves is a poltergeist, and he threatens to get the Bloody Baron involved if Peeves doesn't show himself immediately. So, Peeves does, and he swoops at the first years, which causes them all to duck. So, Percy tells Peeves to go away or the Baron will hear about it, which causes Peeves to stick out his tongue and vanish. So, Percy says that the first year should watch out for Peeves because the Bloody Baron is the only one who can control him, and Peeves won't even listen to the prefects. At the end of the corridor they're walking down, there is a portrait of a very fat woman in a pink silk dress, and she asks for a password, and Percy gives it to her, and the portrait swings open and reveals a round hole in the wall. So all of the first year Gryffindors go through, and it says that Neville needed a leg up, and I never really realized that apparently this hole is like, it's literally only a hole. It's not like a hole the size of a door. I always thought of it as being pretty large, so you might only need to kind of take a step up and duck down. And this makes me wonder, how does McGonagall get through? Because I can't imagine her just scrambling through this hole like a kid, like she is an old woman. No offense, McGonagall, but she is an old woman. I don't even know how old she is, but she is not that young. So, I have a theory. McGonagall, like, we know she can change into a cat, so I wonder, does she give the portrait the password and it opens, and as she turns into a cat, and then jumps through and turns into a cat when she gets on the other side? Because I feel like that's the only way I can really imagine her doing it. But Percy directs the girls through one door to their dorm, and the boys to another, and they go through, and there's a spiral staircase, so they know that they're obviously in one of the towers. And the narrator said that there are 5 4-poster beds in the dorm, which I did some calculations for this. So if there are 5 beds in their dorm and there are 7 years total, that means that there should be 35 beds for boys per house, right? So we can assume that there are an equal amount of girls. So that would, and so 35 times 4 would be 140, which means that there are 140 boys. And we can just assume for the sake of this that there are also 140 girls, which means that there are 280 students in this school. And that means that it is, like, incredibly small. Like, I went to school with about 800 kids in middle school, and we would talk about how small we were, but Hogwarts would be less than half the size of that. So that is a bit bonkers to me. And I know that it is entirely possible, and I thought of this while I was doing the math, that the castle knows what it needs, so they can create as many beds as necessary for that year. So it's entirely possible that in other years, in other houses, or in like Gryffindor House, let's say there was a year where there were 12 students in Ravenclaw that were girls, so the dormitory would have 12 beds. So my calculations can be entirely discarded, but for the sake of argument, this school is looking pretty small. Anyway, all of their trunks were already there because they had been brought up to their dorm, and everyone is tired, so they just pull out their pajamas and get into bed. And Harry has a strange dream that he is wearing Professor Quirrell's turban, and it keeps talking to him and telling him that he needs to transfer to Slytherin because it is his destiny. And Harry told the turban that he didn't want to be in Slytherin, so the turban got heavier and heavier, and it tightened whenever he tried to pull it off. In this dream, Draco Malfoy was laughing at him as he struggled with it, and then Malfoy turned into Snape, whose laugh was high and cold, and there was a burst of green light, and Harry woke up sweating and shaking, so he rolled over and fell asleep again, but by the time he woke up in the morning the next day, he didn't remember his dream at all. And that is the end of Chapter 7 of Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, the Sorting Hat. And right now, I'm feeling kind of like a kid in a candy shop reading this, because this is, I feel like the first time I read it, I was just trying to get through the book really quickly so that I could know what would happen, but now I'm literally just doing this to understand and analyze and have fun, and I'm trying to look at the details more so I get to enjoy it more than I did the first time, because I'm really taking my time. And I also want to say that I, like, try to get my genuine reactions to these chapters, so it's not like I read the whole book or something and I took notes on it and I'm just, like, reading what I have. What I do is I read a specific section of the book, let's say chapters 7 and 8, and I won't read anymore until after I've recorded the episode so that I'm not incorporating information that I would not have remembered if I hadn't read further along in the book. And I think that kind of preserves, like, the surprise that I have, so I'm not so far ahead in the book. And yeah, this chapter was really fun, and I completely forgot about the Hogwarts song, and I think that we got some really great Fred and George moments in this chapter, and I didn't even know how much of a fan I am of them until I started rereading this, because, like, I've always known that they were cool, but now they're, like, extra cool in my book. So before we go on to chapter 8, we're going to have a message from our sponsor. Welcome back, and without further ado, let's get into chapter 8, the Potions Master. So we left off of chapter 7 with Harry going to his dorm and going to sleep, and we start off chapter 8 the next day, and Harry is constantly being watched and people are whispering about him and trying to get a good look at him, and this kind of annoys him because he is just trying to find his way to his classes. We also learn that there are 142 staircases at Hogwarts, and some of them move depending on the day, and some have, like, a step that vanishes, so you have to jump there in order to not, like, hurt yourself. There are also a lot of cool doors in the castle that won't open unless you ask politely or tickle them in a specific way, and some doors are not actually doors at all and they're just walls. So Harry has a hard time remembering where everything is because it seems like everything moves around a lot, and the people in the portraits go visit each other a lot, and Harry also thinks that the coats of armor can walk. So all of the ghosts except for Nearly Headless Nick were pretty useless, but he would help the new Gryffindors find their way around, and Peeps the Poltergeist was really unhelpful and would drop waste paper baskets on you or pull rugs from under your feet. And Argus Filch, we know he's the caretaker, and he is even worse than Peeves. And Harry and Ron managed to get on his wrong side on their very first morning because they were trying to open the door to the entrance to the corridor on the third floor, and he just would not believe that they were actually lost. So Filch has a cat named Mrs. Norris, and she patrols the corridors alone, and if she sees any rule breaking, she'll run off really quickly to get Filch, and he would come around the corner about 2 seconds later. And this is because Filch knows the secret passageways around the school better than anyone except the Weasley twins, so he can get around really quickly, which means that all of the students hate him. So Harry found out very quickly that there was a lot more to magic than just waving your wand and saying funny words, and he has to study the night sky through a telescope every Wednesday at midnight. And I'm not gonna lie, that just kind of sounds ridiculous. How do you have 11-year-old kids having class at midnight? And that, I assume that's when the class starts, so by the time they actually go back to bed, it might not even and be like 2 a.m. or later, and they still have class in the morning, don't they? So that literally doesn't give them enough time to get proper sleep. So 3 times a week, they have herbology in the greenhouse with Professor Sprout. And I just think that this name was kind of lazy and it was really low-hanging fruit. Why do so many of the professors that we'll come to find out will have last names that relate to the subject that they teach? What if Professor Sprout decided that she wanted to teach Muggle studies? That would kind of throw a wrench in the naming system. So their most boring lesson is History of Magic, and it is taught by Professor Binns, who is a ghost because one night he fell asleep in the staff room in front of the fire, and he woke up the next morning to teach and just left his body. And Professor Flitwick is the charms teacher, and he is very short and has to stand on a pile of books to see over his desk. And during the first lesson, he saw Harry's name on his roster and gave an excited squeak and toppled out of sight. And next we learn that Professor McGonagall is the transfiguration teacher, and she is very strict, and during their first lesson, she changes her desk into a pig, and all of the students are very impressed. So they take a ton of notes, and they're given a match to try to turn into a needle, but only Hermione has made any difference with her match by the end of the lesson. And that gets her a smile from McGonagall, which is rare. So everyone is excited and was looking forward to Defense Against the Dark Arts, but Quirrell's lessons are kind of a joke. His classroom smells like garlic, and he told them that his turban was given to him by an African prince as a thank you for getting rid of a zombie, but the students aren't so sure that they believe this story. So I'm happy to see that even the students know that this is kind of BS, and it's a bit weird that Quirrell's just wearing a turban around. So apparently, when Seamus Finnegan asked how he fought off the zombie, Quirrell went pink and started talking about the weather. And everyone noticed that there was like a funny smell around the turban, and the Weasley twins insisted that it was also full of garlic so that Quirrell was protected wherever he went. And Harry is relieved, like, with his classes because he sees that a lot of people had come from Muggle families, so he's not terribly far behind anyone else. And Friday is the first time that Harry and Ron get to the Great Hall without getting lost, and they have double potions with the Slytherins that day, and Ron says that Snape is the head of Slytherin House, and everyone says that he favors them. And eventually, a ton of owls swoop down through, like, the rafters and deliver the mail. And this shocked everyone on the first morning, but now they're used to it. And Hedwig hadn't delivered Harry any mail yet, but she sometimes flew in to nibble on his ear and have some toast before going to the owlery with the school owls. But this morning, she swooped down and dropped a note from Hagrid onto Harry's plate that was inviting him to go to Hagrid's hut and have a cup of tea with him. And Harry agrees and sends Hedwig back with the note. So the potions classroom is down in one of the dungeons, and it is very cold and creepy. And by the end of the first potions lesson, Harry just knows that Snape absolutely hates him. When he got to Harry's name on the class list, he called Harry their new celebrity, and that made Draco Malfoy and Crabbe and Goyle snigger behind their hands. And real quick, I am all for the creative use of vocabulary words, but why snigger and not snicker? You're literally one letter off from getting canceled, Joanne. But I just think that's really funny. So apparently Snape's eyes are black like Hagrid's, but they aren't warm. They're cold and empty and make you think of dark tunnels. And Snape gives this long, pompous speech about how potion making is an art, and there won't be any foolish wand waving, and that many people just won't understand potions. And there's a silence, which makes Harry and Ron look at each other and raise their eyebrows, and the narrator says that Hermione Granger was on the edge of her seat and looked desperate to start proving that she wasn't a dunderhead. So, Snape, of course, has to call out Harry and ask what he would get if he added powdered root of asphodel to an infusion of wormwood. And Hermione's hand shoots up into the air, of course, so Harry says that he doesn't know. So Snape just decides to be a complete jerk and says that fame isn't everything. And he just ignores Hermione's hand. And then he asks where Harry would look if he told him to find him a Beezor. And Hermione's hand goes right back up. And now Malfoy, Crabbe, and Goyle are laughing because Harry just doesn't know. So then Snape asks Harry, did he think he wouldn't open a book before coming? And asks what the difference between monkshood and wolfsbane is. But Harry says that he doesn't know, but Hermione looks like she does, so he should ask her. And good on you, Harry! Be the messy queen that you are! Don't let Snape walk all over you. And a few people laugh at this, but Snape snapped at her to sit down and then says that asphodel and wormwood make a sleeping potion that is so powerful it is known as the draught of living death. And a Beezor is a stone taken from the stomach of a goat that will save you from most potions. And monkshood and wolfsbane are the same plant, and it also goes by the name of aconite. And then he turns and asks why everyone isn't copying it down. So the potion lesson is still going like crap, and Snape splits everyone up into pairs and has them make a simple potion to cure boils, and walks around and criticizes everyone except Draco Malfoy. And Neville had somehow managed to melt Seamus's cauldron, and it was like in a twisted blob, and their potion was getting on the floor and burning holes in everyone's shoes. So Snape calls Neville an idiot boy, and Neville whimpers as boils start popping up all over his nose. So Snape tells Seamus to take him to the hospital wing. And like, okay, whatever. That wasn't very nice of him to call him an idiot boy, but at least he didn't tell him to, like, deal with it and just, like, suffer with boils on his face. And then Snape just decides to be an absolute jerk even more than he already has been. And he turns on Harry and Ron because they had been working next to Neville. And he asks Harry why he didn't tell Neville not to add the porcupine quills, and asks if Harry thought that he would look good if Neville did it wrong. So he takes another point from Gryffindor. So Harry knows this is unfair, and being the messy queen he is about to speak up and argue, but Ron kicks him under the cauldron and says not to push it. And Ron also says on their way from the dungeons that it's okay because Snape is always taking points from friend George, and he asks if he can come meet Hagrid with Harry. So at 2:55, they leave the castle and make their way across the grounds to Hagrid's small wooden house on the edge of the Forbidden Forest. And when he knocks on the door, there are several booming barks, and Hagrid's voice is heard telling Fang to back up. So he opens the door, and we learn that Fang is a black boarhound, and he is enormous. And however, this house is only one room, so he tells Harry and Ron to make themselves at home, and he lets go of Fang, and he starts licking Ron's ears, and Harry introduces Hagrid and Ron to each other. So Hagrid says that he spent half of his life chasing the Weasley twins away from the Forbidden Forest, and offers them rock cakes that almost break their teeth. But Harry and Ron are polite, and they pretend to enjoy them. And they tell Hagrid about their first lessons and how everything went. And Fang rested his head on Harry's knee and drooled all over his robes. Very wholesome so far. At one point while they're talking, Hagrid calls Filch an old git, which makes Harry and Ron happy. And Hagrid also says that he would like to introduce Mrs. Norris to Fang sometime, because she follows him everywhere when he goes into the school. So Harry tells Hagrid about their potion lesson, and he says that Snape really seems to hate Harry more than he hates everyone else. But Hagrid asks why should he, and tries to change the topic really quickly, and asks Ron about his brother Charlie, and says that he liked him a lot and he was great with animals. Harry wonders if Hagrid changed the subject on purpose, and Ron tells Hagrid that all of Charlie's work is with dragons right now, And that is when Harry sees a piece of paper on the table that is a cutting from the Daily Prophet, the newspaper, and it is about the Gringotts break-in. Apparently, the Gringotts bank was broken into on July 31st, and everyone thinks that dark witches or wizards did it, and the Gringotts goblins insist that nothing had been taken because the vault was emptied that same day. So Harry speaks up and says that the Gringotts break-in happened on his birthday and they might have been there while it was happening. So Hagrid doesn't meet his eyes and offers him another rock cake, but Harry realizes that the article says that it was emptied on the same day, which means that the vault that was broken into was probably the same vault that Hagrid had gone into and taken the little package out of, which was Vault 713, and they were probably looking for whatever Hagrid had taken out. So Harry and Ron walk back to the castle for dinner, and they have a ton of rock cakes in their pockets because they were too polite to refuse them, and Harry thinks that none of his lessons have given him as much to think about as his tea with Hagrid was, because as I have stated before, Harry is a nosy B-word, and he's just wondering what is in that package, and where it is, and, like, what's going on with it, and if Hagrid knows something about Snape that he doesn't want to tell Harry. And that is the end of Chapter 8, The Potions Master, of Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. I'm not gonna lie, I, like, didn't really remember as nearly as many details as I thought. Like, I didn't remember that Snape criticized Harry for not helping Neville, or that Harry finds out about the Gringotts break-in from the Daily Prophet at Hagrid's hut. And I feel like right now the story is finally beginning to, like, gain momentum, because Harry's just being the messy queen that he is. And he refuses to mind his business. Well, I guess he shouldn't, but anyway, he won't mind his business, and that's going to help him find out what's going on. So I hope that you all enjoyed this episode of Up to No Good, and if you did, please leave a rating and a review. You don't even have to really type anything, just, like, give me the 5 stars. And if you did enjoy this, please just tell one person that you know about this podcast so that people will listen to it. And I just want to thank you again for listening to this episode. I am Lindsay Taylor Siplin, your host, and I can be found on Instagram and YouTube at Lindsay Siplin. That's just my first name and my last name. That's the at @LindseySiplin. Up to No Good is written, created, edited, and produced by Lindsay Taylor Siplin. Goodbye for now, and I'll talk to you next week.